Hello, hello, and welcome to the 18th Metroplexity Podcast. This is Kinnick, also known as Landon Winkler, back in Columbus after a hopefully well-earned vacation in Australia and New Zealand, which was pretty fantastic. Back now and, you know, back to doing anything other than purely putting out fires with Metroplexity, so got the podcast here. Probably be a pretty long one, judging by the fact that the thread crested a page, but we shall see. First question we have from Gold S. Hints on acquiring item 1170. In case anyone who's listening isn't familiar with sort of the back end of the game, if you look at the code of the page for, like, the inventory, you'll see that the items, like, the used links will be, like, equip dash, you know, 3 or whatever, and that number is a unique identifier for the item. And nobody's found item 1170 yet. My best advice for it, honestly, is not to worry about it too much. It's one of those things that is probably gonna stay undiscovered for quite a while, and any hint I give you will be starting in the middle. So I would work on other stuff, and something else will take you through there, if that helps. But I wouldn't really focus directly on that. You won't find it looking for it that way. A couple questions from Francis Vixen. Now that the avatar's been discovered, is there still more to be discovered with virtual pet bass? Could I get a quote on the placement on the scale of awesomeness? The awesomeness of the pet bass is not really in, like, its, you know, game-breaking amazingness or anything like that. There is some stuff that still hasn't been discovered, which is varying degrees of story adorable, and, you know, pet bassiness, but I don't think there's anything else you're looking for that's really game affecting. I would say it's just the sort of thing that, like, when somebody who really has a, really hearts it, sits down and plays with it for a bit, there's some more interesting stuff there. Not, like I said, in the sense that, you need it to be optimal, or even optimal in fishing, but just sort of neat for neatness' sake. Is there more to be discovered with the viral model? Are there more mediums of art for it? Scale of awesome quote. The viral model is more or less self-contained. The awesomeness is more on the fact that you can craft it side, which I just think is pretty cool. Like, it unlocking that crafting. Is there any hidden content with the viral eavesdropper? Scale of awesome quote. I'm pretty sure that there's something fairly significant that hasn't been uncovered with that. You'll have to forgive me for a moment. I'm sorry, I was thinking about one of the other viral utilities. No, that's also mostly just awesomeness for awesomeness' sake. I mean, the, I don't think there's anything big and unfound there. How hard is it until inactive SD micros can be repaired and made active? That would be part of the PAT system, whenever I put that in. So, whenever that rolls out, those would become active. The spherical eggs that you find on the shore, or destroy on the shore, that the Fae lead you to, would be hatchable then. And there's one other item that is less obviously useless now. I don't want to say it's not useless now, so it's not obvious that something extra would be going into it. And those three are sort of foreshadowing of the PAT system, along with, you know, some of the just assume I didn't say along with at the end of the sentence, but they will be part of the PAT system along with, you know, a bunch of new stuff that will roll out actually then, because obviously not all PATs will either come from items or, you know, come from items that are available now. Any chance of there being an interaction in the future with the Children's Bane set and Stolen Artistry? Unlikely. The Children's Paint set will have some expanded content at some point. It probably won't be related to Stolen Artistry. I'm pretty sure I haven't said this recently, but Stolen Artistry is sort of a black hole for content, if that makes any sense. There's so much content there already that adding more content to it just seems really kind of unfair to the rest of the game. And I don't blame everyone else for wanting to have more content added to it, because it's awesome, and that's why it already has so much content in it. And so many, you know, neat little interactions. But there comes a time, you know, where I just have to spread out the love some. And there's actually still a lot of stuff under Stolen Artistry that people haven't found, sort of in the tree of Stolen Artistry, like, not at the root of, you can see my gesticulations right now, by the way. The root is actually at the top, and the rest of the tree is at the bottom, because I'm crazy, but the, not at, like, the root with the choice options, but there's a bunch of other stuff that just hasn't been found yet. Is it possible to get Oceanside and Faceside going simultaneously? I only ask because Puyo has both skills. There was a bug for a while in the very, very early game that allowed you to get both of them. You basically just complete the quest twice. Because the encounters weren't turning off properly. So that's why she has both of them. And it works fine. They're coded so that it's functional when that happens. But it's not. If it were possible now, it would be a bug. How about that? The code on that quest is very old, so it wouldn't entirely shock me if there were some loophole in there that would let people get both of them. But it's just, it's not really very high on my priority list to revise, as at the moment it isn't broken, so it'll probably sit the way it is until something actually happens. By the way, your art is incredible, Puyo. Yeah, thanks. I will pass that on to her. And wait till you see the latest batches she's given me for the mirror. I think she's really outdone herself. any chance of there being an interaction in the future between the Lotus Map skill and the rating database? Not a bad idea, but the rating database is referring to places outside of Metroplex, which you, well, this will get elaborated on a lot more later, but it's not terribly easy to get to them. There hasn't been any cause yet, but it's also not the easiest thing in the world to get to a lot of the locations that your database is talking about. But there might be a seed of an idea in there. Let's see. Switching over to Al. How were your adventures down south? Pretty amazing. Let's see. So, we traveled for pretty much an entire day, going out there. I went from Columbus over to, LAX and, down to Sydney. And flew Qantas, which, by the way, is amazing. If anyone ends up flying in that part of the world, I would highly suggest Qantas. They're just actually one of the reoccurring themes throughout our entire vacation is that the tour folks and the airlines in particular totally eat like hobbits, encourage everyone else to eat like hobbits. So it's not like, you know, flying even a nicer U.S. airline, where it's like, oh, you know, you've got a 3-hour flight, like, here's your, you know, bag of peanuts, or like, you know, more likely than not, pretzels now, because so many people were allergic. This was like, oh, you've got a 3-hour flight, like, here's, like, the least that we were fed on any flight the entire time we were down there. And we flew a lot, just like, you know, puddle jumper type flights between cities, was like a fairly nice, like, exile sandwich, like that, and then snacks and drinks. And most of the time it was actually like a fairly good lunch or dinner. And flying back and forth, they had a Cadbury hot chocolate, which, oh my God, I kind of want to see if we can get a hold of it here, but I kind of don't want to know. Anyway, but yeah, Qantas was amazing. And New Zealand was also pretty shockingly good. Actually, I'm gonna go on a continuing airline tangent. So this may not seem weird to folks outside the States, but in the States, airport security has been an increasingly vile issue. I mean, it was kind of dumb, you know, when I was growing up, but since September 11th, it's just gotten dumber and dumber and dumber. But we're in New Zealand, and we're flying from, I forget which two cities it was, but we were flying from, like, one of their larger airports, flying out of one of their larger airports, and it wasn't actually a huge airport. It was the airport at Rotorua, which is a sort of a touristy place. But we, you know, get our tickets, and there's, like, a surtax for the town, because, like, they spent a bunch of money to make the airport nicer. So we go over to the desk for that, and they'll get us a stamp, and we go, and we sit at the gate. And we're like, we feel like we're forgetting something. And we sit around, and we're like, what did we totally not do? Because, like, we got our stamps, so that's good, and we obviously have our boarding passes, so that's fine. And we realized that there was just not a security desk there. Like, we just walked over and sat down at our terminal, and it was pretty much the greatest thing ever. Made traveling there so much more pleasant. Like, it was, like, coming back into the States, it was like, welcome to the United States of America, where you were treated like a criminal. It was kind of awful, actually. That was pretty awesome. And, like, even the places that had security, it was, like, the old-fashioned, pre-September 11th, like, walk through the x-ray machine and, you know, put your put your bag on the conveyor belt and, you know, separate your laptop was the only thing that was remotely different from when I remember flying from when I was, like, six, which was fine and pleasant, and now flying just kind of sucks. So, big fan of that. Anyway, so, the traveling part aside, we went to Sydney, which was very nice. I don't really want to live there. It's very expensive. But we, got to the Chinese gardens, which were very, very cool. I think I mentioned this actually in my posting, but they had, so, like, it's very much, like, they have a huge Chinese population there, and this was, like, a friendship garden that was handled between, like, their sort of, like, sister province in China and the folks in Sydney. But it was very cool with the, well, it was a traditional Chinese garden, I shouldn't really say it was in a garden. It had the, you know, the stones and, you know, the various species of trees and flowers and so forth. And the pagodas and whatnot. There's so many koi. It was just kind of absurd. Like, it looked like, in places, it looked like you just, like, walk on the koi across the surface of the water. Because there were just swarms of them. But the, so we go through the whole thing. And, like, we were passing out through, like, the gift shop to leave, basically. Because, you know, that's how you roll. But, there's this door to the left of the gift shop, and I'm like, oh, like, maybe that's the way out. Like, I wonder what's back there. And I go in there, and there's a carriage, like a, almost like a rickshaw type thing. Although I think, like, just that type of design, I don't think was designed to be pulled by a person. Made out of jade. Just the whole freaking thing. The little, like, information card was, like, made out of 2 tons of jade. And they had a jade pole arm of a type that I'm not going to remember the name of, but the sort of fluted blade on the end of the pole that you see fairly often in, like, Romance of the Three Kingdoms and stuff like that. And also made out of just, like, a giant chunk of jade, and just so elaborate. Like, it had flags on it, like, you know, flags flirting the breeze that were made out of jade. Like, little jade flags. And, like, you know, like, the straps and, like, the little stool that you stepped on to get into the carriage, all jade. And it was, you know, just, it was made for, it's like a bridal carriage for a, someone who was either going to be an imperial princess or an empress. And so, like, it was, you know, one of the gifts, you know, one of her wedding gifts, basically. Only one outside of China, apparently, but the thing that really weirded me out about it, like, wasn't that there was this, you know, amazing, and if you can't tell, I'm a huge, you know, fan of jade. Jade is just awesome. But, it was just like, oh yeah, like, you know, you're walking out, like, you know, and there's just this door that, like, has nothing directing you towards, like, this, you know, work of art that you would otherwise probably never have a chance to see unless you were in somewhere like the Forbidden City, which I was in, and I don't recall seeing anything, honestly, quite that cool there, but I was very young then, so I might have missed something awesome. Let's see. We visited the aquarium there, too. The Sydney Aquarium. Which, so, like, on one side, you've got the fact that they've got, like, you know, like, platypus and, like, huge, like, glass tunnel things with all the, in, like, a huge thing with all the sharks. And a separate one with all the stuff like dugongs and whatnot. Which are very cool. Dugongs, very similar to manatees, for reference. Also, not coincidentally at all, the evolved form of seal in Pokemon. Just saying. But, so they've, all of that, and that was all really cool, but and we actually got to see a platypus, which is good. But, the two things that, at least, the three things that really struck me, one was that they had a, think it's probably the Discovery Channel, but the Discovery Channel and, like, our National Geographic Channel, the Learning Channel, and all these sorts of, like, nominally educational programming have sort of the same problem that, like, the music channels like MTV and VH1 had, in that they found that they have this really good idea, like, showing, you know, educational programming or showing music videos, but that, like, the more they sort of diverge from their mission, the more money they make. And obviously, like, the educational channels, like, you kind of feel less good about them diverging from their mission, and having stuff like, you know, Orange County Choppers or whatever, and Ice Road Truckers, which may be awesome, I have no idea, it's just not what I would really think they should be showing. Not that I watch television, but they had a moral of the story. They had a sort of speculative biology presentations throughout it that had, like, you know, after, you know, the fall of mankind in, like, a billion years or something, I don't remember the time span they're using, you know, what will species look like, with a focus, obviously, on, you know, the aquatic species. But it was taken from some sort of speculative, not really documentary type thing. And so some of them were just like, you know, like sharks that are also, you know, electric, like electric eels are, which would actually be really handy in some ways, like in that, like if they had an electric sense, they could, you know, sense the neural activity of stuff, sort of like a platypod do, actually. But they also could, like, you know, zot stuff. And it was like, wow, that's totally a D&D monster. And then, of course, there was the giant, freakish, like, elephantine land squid. Were, like, supposed to be, like, several tons. And I'm not really sure how their speculative biology people handle the fact of, like, them not having, like, a skeleton so much. Like, they have their, mantle, I believe it's called, the sort of, like, carapace. But, like, that's kind of it. And, I don't think that you could have an elephant with just, like, an exoskeleton. But far be it for me to disagree with whatever, you know, wacky dudes they had, presenting. Anyway, so there was that, which was just kind of weird and distracting, kind of humorous. But they, they, to sort of counteract this, then raise up the awesome, they had giant freaking Lego sculptures all over the place. Like, in the entryway, they had a Lego Poseidon. It was probably good, like, I would say at least 9 feet tall, like, easily taller than I am. Probably closer to, like, 12 feet tall. Just, like, made out of, like, a normal size Lego. It was just huge freaking Lego dude. And, like, a giant Lego, white whale. It's like a Lego mosaic of Ahab behind it, and like a Lego mermaid and all these sorts of things. Those are just like, I'm not an antiquarian to look at your Lego sculptures, but these are friggin' awesome. But the other thing that was just very, kind of iconically Australian on some level with that was the, there was a chunk of hallway that we were walking down, and I realized that in, like, my sort of, you know, science dweeb narration to Liz, I had said, oh, this is X, the most poisonous Y on the planet, like, 3 times in the length of this maybe, like, 50-foot hallway. I don't remember what the first one was, but it was, first one might have been even the platypus, because, you know, there's really a lot of competition there. But then the rockfish, and then the blue-ringed octopus, which are adorable. I did not realize how cute they were. They're tiny little octopi, but, like, incredibly toxic. Which is just kind of funny, because, like, their tentacles look like little styrofoam bits of string, almost. They're so thin. Blue-ringed octopus, really cool. Anyway. So Oh, and we visited like a petting zoo type thing, so I got to feed some kangaroos and pet a koala and whatnot, which is good. Koala did not rip my arm off and beat me to death with it, which was appreciated. Probably would have taken too much energy. So that was Sydney. I would probably like and not have felt bad skipping Sydney, but it was nice. That more saying that the other stuff is so awesome that I wouldn't have minded more of it displacing Sydney. But on its own merits, Sydney was pretty awesome. Then we went out to Uluru, which is Ayers Rock. So it's Uluru Kadajuta National Park. I forget if it's Kadajuta or Kadajula. But there's another rock formation fairly nearby, which is called the Olgas, which is just a lame name, but I can never remember if it's Kadajula or Kadajuta. I think it's Kadajula. That was just really friggin' awesome. It was really kind of, that was the place that we were most like, can we just stay here? Which is really funny, because, like, I don't like deserts, and I don't like sunlight. I really kind of prefer, well, I guess I don't like deserts because I don't like sunlight. Like, I'd really prefer it to be kind of overcast all the time, like Seattle, basically. But the guides and the people were all very, very cool. But the, like, so, okay, on a, you've probably run into at some point the idea that people, like, learn things differently. Like, some people are, you know, visual learners, and some people are kinesthetic learners, and some people are oral learners, and so forth. I feel that there's also a fairly distinct difference between how people remember things, in that, like, some people are really good at, you know, remembering numbers and can relate other things to numbers to remember stuff. But the way that I actually remember stuff is as stories. So if something happens and doesn't get put into, like, a narrative for me, my internal monologue, it basically doesn't get stored into long-term memory. And it was really interesting in that the Ananu, the Aboriginal peoples that were there, were really, and as far as you can tell, like, the Aboriginal peoples through most of the rest of Australia, were very much in that same, remembered things in a very similar way. So it was this idea of their stories. I mean, like, every group of people, you know, throughout history has, you know, their creation myth and, like, how things got the way they are and, like, why we should be allowed to rule the planet and everyone else can suck it, sort of, like, myths. But even, like, the Ananu are very cagey with their stories, in that traditionally there are actually many versions of the stories, like, even within the same tribe, and the, like, there's, like, the kids' version, basically, like, the, you know, George Washington chopped down the cherry tree version to some extent, I would think. But, you know, just a very, like, very simple, very glossed over sort of, like, general, like, you know, here's your moral, or, you know, go eat your vegetables sort of thing. And through, like, and then increasingly, like, you know, once you're, you know, a full adult, full member of the tribe, different version. Which is really interesting in its own regard, but, so we're getting, like, the kid's life, basically, which is fine. We probably wouldn't have time to hear more than one or two of them in the full version. But even within that very narrow sort of slice, you could hear. Sorry for that terrible shrieking noise. I had to close the window because there's a dog barking out there. Doesn't seem to have helped much. But within the within even that very narrow slice, there's this really interesting. Instead of like information, like there's obviously this layer of like, you know, this is, you know, what happened during, you know, ancient times when, you know, the creation beings walked the earth, whatever. You know, like it's a good story, kind of explains a little bit of how things are the way they are. But within that, there's you would have these tracts of just underlying information. So the same story about it's a story about a conflict between basically two snake tribes, almost would be the way to put that. The Woma Python tribe and the basically the poison snake tribe. Liru was the name of the other one. And so, like, okay, so you've got, like, this layer of, like, yeah, it's, you know, an interesting story, but, like, the stages of the story occur at different physical locations and explain those physical locations, relating them back to the story. Which is interesting in that once you know even a couple of the stories, like, we only really heard three or four of them, you have this sort of, if you were to know them reasonably well, you would actually have a fairly coherent map of the area. And you would see these, like the rock formations, the various markings, and be able to tell, most importantly, really, where the waterfalls are. Because they're really only, like, the two waterfalls around Uluru. And then, like, you're just kind of aft for miles and miles and miles. So, that's important. But there's also underlying, like, the conflict between the two shows the differences in the, sort of like the, in a new criminal justice system, almost. Like, if a guy does something that's, bad enough to be, you know, worth really being punished for. He gets stuck in the leg with a spear, like, badly. And then gets nursed back to health. That's kind of how they roll. Like, it's like, okay, you've been stuck with a spear, you know, forgive and forget, we'll patch you up. And if the, on the sort of woman's side, they crack you with a digging stick, which is basically a club. It would not be pleasant either. Probably go for that before the spear, though. But anyway, that's sort of, but that's also illustrated in the story, so you can see sort of like this, the cultural, aspect to it. And then, there's also this interesting, like, biological layer in that, the Woma python, like, in nature, will actually prey on, the species of snake that they're talking about. And then, I mean, you just sort of layer them all on top of each other, so you have this, sort of this, bush knowledge, cultural, you know, sort of lesson, and, like, you know, the basic, like, moral type stuff, and this, you know, underlying, like, both, you know, how the world is the way it is as far as, like, how objects are physically arranged, but just this very basic understanding of how the land is put together, in a web of life sense. So, those were all really cool, and I really, enjoyed, talking to them, and, you know, looking at their art, and there was, if I went back, I would probably do all of the, Anna New Guide tours. the other two are just kind of like, I don't even really want to say badass. They're just, there's this sort of underlying concept of like the noble savage that is very popular in Western culture, of like, you know, you have like the you know, the people of, you know, elves in a lot of senses, people of, you know, the forest or the plains or whatever, before, you know, the Westerner came, they're all, you know, amazing and whatnot, and perfect and without flaws, etc., etc. You know, we need to go back to this primal state. If you haven't heard this from someone, you don't know enough hippies. But it was very interesting to see, I mean, a lot of, I mean, we sort of, you know, you run into the history of the native peoples of each area as you're going through. But it was very striking how much they were that, above and beyond what, like, the other cultures were doing, like the Maori and New Zealand, who are very nice people, don't get me wrong, but, like, we're kind of warlike and, you know, cannibalistic and hunted the Moa to extinction and stuff like that. So they weren't exactly model citizens even before the Westerners came in and screwed stuff up even worse. But they very much do fall into that, which is really neat. And yeah, that was probably like our favorite place. We were looking at like their message board, and they were like, "Ah, they need a cook for their daycare. Like, could we swing that? Could we be a cook for their daycare?" That's sort of where we were at leaving Ulara, which is the sort of tourist town on the edge of the park. They don't let people actually stay in the park anymore, which is good. So I could talk endlessly about that, but we also went to Cairns, which is very cool. Got to scuba dive in the Great Barrier Reef and see the giant Tonkoff metroplexity clams. Did not feed it any tainted blood, so my black pearl quotient was very low. That was neat, although a little like panic inducing. In parts, I still had a bit of a cold. When my ear finally adjusted, it was well, they were actually coming back up with like the sun streaming down and like all the really beautiful tropical fish around, like this huge swarm of them. We were actually coming back up while the people on board the boat were doing like their daily fish feed that they're allowed to do. Like, they basically get one a day, so they were doing that as we were coming back up. And so we're coming in this swarm of fish with the like almost like disco ball light from the top, and you know, completely lose all sense of equilibrium, which was kind of terrifying at the time, but like neat in retrospect. Anyway, that aside, saw some really cool stuff. We got to go up into their rainforest near the mountains there. Cairns was actually doing pretty well. They got, shortly after we made our plans originally, they got hit by a pretty serious, hurricane, or typhoon, I guess, in the hemisphere. But they had already gotten that more or less sorted out, which was good. And then from there we went to, up to New Zealand, which, Liz and I were both under this impression that, like, New Zealand and Australia, like, shared a fair bit, like, ecologically, which is not the case at all, like, even a little bit, other than, you know, things that have been moved, by humans. Their trees, their native trees are, like, crazy primordial, the most common ones in a lot of parts of the country are just, like, old school, and by old school, I mean, like, dinosaur school fern trees, which is really cool. Lots of ferns, just in general. But the other native trees were just not really similar at all to what we're familiar with. Like the carry tree, which is just basically a ship's mast with branches at the top, which is why there aren't many of them anymore, because you could basically just like cut it down, strip the bark off, and put it on a ship, like length of 60 plus feet, just like beautiful, not free, like hardwood. Well, not technically hardwood or softwood, because they're ancient and weird, but moral of the story is that's why there aren't any anymore. Yeah. But, yeah, we tooled around New Zealand, ended up doing a lot of the Lord of the Rings tours. If anybody, for whatever bizarre reason, is in New Zealand before the Hobbit comes out, or, like, probably after the Hobbit comes out, visit Hobbiton. They have... they actually have it open to tourists on most days right now, even though, like, it's a filming set. They've rebuilt it on the site that they used for Lord of the Rings. And so they actually are letting people in as long as you don't post your pictures to the internet. it roped off such that... The tourists coming through will actually wear the paths that they want for the roads of Hobbiton, which I thought was adorable. It's just very meta for you. We did get to visit Weta to the extent that you can. They have a little like museum / gift shop type thing. That's really cool. But you obviously they just for non-disclosure reasons they can't let you just wander around. We got to see their giant green screen and a little bit of Rivendell they were working on because they didn't have the warehouse store closed. But that's pretty cool. On that note, finally finished reading Lord of the Rings. Had never actually gotten through it. Started playing D&D before I was introduced to it. Like, got the books because I was, you know... referred to them by Dragon Magazine, basically, when I was, like, 10 or 11. So, might not have even been Dragon Magazine. It might have just been, like, references in the old Red Box. Anyway, but, I could never get through them because D&D stole so much from it. It's kind of like reading a story you've already read before, in a lot of senses. And it's just very, I mean, it's very dry reading in parts. But I finally finished reading some early in the Lord of the Rings, which was good. So I don't have to feel like a complete failure as a geek anymore. Actually, I enjoyed the Silmarillion a lot more. I enjoyed reading Lord of the Rings a lot more after reading the Silmarillion. So if you're having trouble, you might want to try that. Assuming you can handle, like, the sort of almost, like, epic, not in the, like, hardcore, like, amazing sense, but in, like, the old, like, epic sense, like, epic, not poem, but, like, epic tale, from, like, you know, the Eddas and Beowulf and so forth. If you can handle that type of literature, I would actually, and have any problems with Lord of the Rings, which is where I was just reading, somewhere in the first, and it makes all of the references that he's, like, oh, when there's this hill, which is, you know, really kind of exciting, because it's this hill, and when you're reading it, you're like, what the hell, read the Silmarillion first. Enough of those references make sense and they stop being irritating. New Zealand was very cool. They both had amazing food. Oh my goodness. I don't think I'm really speaking to our European players here, but you know, in the US most of the stuff we get is like, you know, factory farmed meat and giant farmed, you know, fruits and veggies. And not so much of that down there. I'm sure there were some, and there was some stuff that was imported that I'm sure was grown that way, but it was very much just like this. It was like stuff isn't labeled as free range because, like, we just don't bother factory stuff. Actually, it was kind of funny. So in New Zealand, when the Europeans came over, well, the English, obviously, mostly, they were like, oh, you know, we need to have, you know, our deer for our hunts, because that's, you know, I guess very British. And so they released a bunch of them for their hunts. And they're the only thing that could have possibly been a predator would be, I'm not even sure if the moa ate meat, but they would have been big enough to kill a deer if they had. But anyway, that aside, nothing even remotely big enough to kill a deer. Like the biggest land animal, biggest native land animal on New Zealand now that the, you know, post moa, is kiwi, which is just not very big. It's about the size of like a chicken, maybe. And have a mean kick. Like could seriously mess your shin up, but like not taking down a deer by any means. Taking down like insects and grubs. But so anyway, of course, the deer ran absolutely wild, as deer are wont to do. But they just went through it. Put them all on farms. Which is kind of adorable. And there are apparently still some in the wild. But they just turn around and up as many of them as they possibly can. And deer are not like the brightest animals, so I would imagine it was not. I mean, it was a massive undertaking, but probably not a particularly difficult one on a one-by-one basis. And yeah, so they have farm-raised venison, which is amazing. I kind of wish that we could get it here, because I really like venison, but farmer's stuff is really, really tender and, of course, gamey. But still has that sort of venison flavor, like that rich venison flavor. So anyway, that was really good. And kangaroo is really good, too. Tastes more like wild venison, actually, which is kind of funny. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, food was really good. Actually, food was just absurdly good. Let's see. There's probably something else. New Zealand. That was crazy, but it's not occurring to me right now. I've spent enough time telling you stories about my vacation. I can get back to questions. But, yeah. Really amazing. I'm sure that I don't have to be like, if you ever get a chance, go and do it, because I would be kind of ashamed if anybody got the chance to go down there and didn't do it. But yeah, totally worth it. Totally worth it. Oh, I guess a slightly additional thing about Lord of the Rings tours. On the day that we went, but the guy who was our guide was actually an extra isn't quite the right word, but like a bit part, I guess, in Return of the King. He was on the scene where Legolas kills the Mumak, the giant elephant, the guy who's driving that elephant, the elephant person, was our guide. The moral of the story there is that he just knew a lot about like the inner workings and this hotel that we're passing is where they were staying while they were shooting here, and this is like how they had to frame this shot for these various reasons and stuff like that. Just really had like a good pulse of the industry feel going, which was very cool. And has a bunch of friends in Weta and stuff, so they can help him out. So that was pretty awesome. Anyway, so Lord of the Rings dorkery aside. Is it intentional that Southside Park looks like a giant eclipse tablet? Yes, actually. I had to ask Puyo the same question at some point. I think it was Liz, was like, it's really cool that it looks like a giant eclipse tablet. And I was like, it looks like a lot? And I was like, holy shit, it does. And then I asked Puyo, and she was like, oh yeah, I thought that was a good idea. Is that okay? I was like, rock on! Yeah, I didn't notice that for a very long time. If a season lasts more than 2 months or so, would you consider starting a new season anyway, even if there's no new unearthly item? Just to shake up the leaderboards a bit, maybe switch up which items are fallible from Zach, especially if changes in the game make so runs early in the season unassailable. Very unlikely. I would either have to advance it without there being a new item, which would result in there being a gap forever, which would be sort of weird, or I guess I could advance it early and then release the item later. But that would really only work for one at a time. Just totally rewrite the rotation stuff. But the rotation stuff is pretty intense. There's a lot of code in that, for a lot of different reasons. So I would be a lot of codependencies. I would be hard pressed to come up with a reason why I would do that. I'll just have to, you know, work harder and get items out in a timely fashion. And not, like, I don't even really want to say slack off exactly, not, well, I mean, vacation aside, there should have been an item out before I left, and I was just not in a mental state to do that, which I don't mean as an excuse at all, that's what happened, and I should have been able to, you know, be a professional, so to speak, and get shit done, but just isn't what happened. Care to share any narrative justifications for how Golden Ship people recognize you between incarnations? I just kind of figured that you chose a username and password, and if you're anything like me, choosing usernames and passwords, they're probably just, you know, hardwired into your brain. Obviously your name doesn't change between incarnations, so it stands to reason that some stuff like that wouldn't either. Which is a pretty weak, you know, narrative justification, but you'll have that. I just really didn't want to... I really didn't want to punish people for resetting. I guess I wanted to have a really strong... Well, a really... like, in-depth sort of... Well, a really high cost for getting into that. But I didn't want to have it be like, every time you reset, you have to do that again, because that would be just a giant pain. Assuming, you know, there was a high cost. If it was just like a, you know, little one-off thing, like the little quest to get access to the golden chip at all, that's fine. But if it's actually, you know, a big deal, and I did want to make it something of a big deal, I wouldn't want to make people repeat it every incarnation. Any comments about how the virus event played out and what's planned for the future of Net PvP? The virus event, I think... It's kind of been a while. But, I mean, obviously it took longer than I was planning on it taking. There was... Which was fine. It didn't really, you know... It was threatening to cause problems if I left before it was done. But that didn't end up happening, so that's good. I think that... The other side of that was, because it was going so slowly, I kind of kept getting interrupted with spikes of bug reports. Like, I would kind of, like, be working on the mirror, I'd get hit with a spike of bug reports, and then, you know, that would get sidelined. Just the switching gears ended up costing me a bunch of time, which is just sort of the way it is. But... I think that it was a really neat event. I think it rolled out a lot of really cool stuff. I think that it's hard to strike a balance between there's sort of a, and I don't think I did a great job on it. I think I was too far to the sort of the obscure side. There's sort of like a couple things you have to balance. There has to be a little bit of mystery, I think. There has to be obviously enough information to make like reasonably informed decisions, and there has to be enough options, enough openness to make reasonably informed decisions. And by informed decisions, I don't mean like that you actually know what the effects of your choices are before you make them. Which might sound retarded. I just think, but what I mean by informed decisions is having a fairly clear idea of what I guess flavor your actions are taking, at least. Like, you need to know either before you take the action or after you take the action, you know, who you're helping. If you're helping anyone. The event was designed to be very sandboxy, so it was more on the mystery side, which I think was frustrating for some people. Although, ironically, every time somebody actually like started to complain about it, we'd hit the next phase. Anyway, with one exception right at the end. But like literally every time it was like someone complained and then like that roll over, or like, you know, give or take, like within 24 hours we would have a new phase of content, which was just kind of, I guess, means that it either means that I was timing it well or timing it poorly, I guess, depending on how you take that. But I'll go with not timing it too badly. How about that? Because we were only getting one person complaining, and it was resolved fairly quickly. But it was, everything was taking a little longer than I thought it would. Until the very last phase, which was kind of on rails, so to speak, the actual golden ship phase. Okay, so that's how I think that I was just faintly dissatisfied with how it played out. Not in like any deep issueful way. I felt like the pacing was off, I guess is the best way to describe that. But other than that, I thought everything was fabulous. So I guess B. there will probably be another world event coming up, which I'm sort of torn as to whether to do before or after Old Town. I might switch gears and go straight for Old Town, get that done, and then do the other world event, which is sort of not quite launching other content in the same way as this one was, but related to some content I want to put in. And what's planned for the future of Net PvP? Basically what you're seeing, although with obviously the board starting to run again. How's the mirror progressing? Good. I have, well, they're sort of like I do like the sort of the rough draft phase, get the art requests in, get the art requests back, go through and do like the more detailed design And that, I was stuck on that for a long time. But that's pretty much done, or at least done enough that I can start doing the actual, like, coding. It'll probably still be a bit, to be perfectly honest. The level of complexity is not like, well, I guess it's pretty complex on the UFACE side too. It's not like weird, mysterious, and complex. It's just a lot of stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of just like item attractions and crafting and stuff that has to go into it. Will there be any rewards for any contents other than the fastest 4 survivors? Nope. Well, I sort of take that back. But really, kind of not. The conducts aren't intended to be things that you do to really get something out of. I mean, that the survivors, you're just you have to get one of them, right? So it's just a question of which box you get sorted into, almost. But the other ones are a separate sort of issue. And those, I don't really So, this is gonna be some splitting hairs. I don't intend to have any rewards for those conducts. I do intend to have some rewards for things, for doing the things that those conducts are for, if that makes any sense. So, like completing all 4 quests, there might be a reward for that, right? Or it might, you know, affect the gameplay further on, which is a reward in itself. But all 4 survivor quests, I guess you probably know what I was talking about. But the conduct itself is separate from that. So I'm not sure if that's, you know, a meaningful division. But the fact that there's a conduct there is not a sign at all that it's something that I will be rewarding. I don't intend to reward those with anything other than the conduct itself. So, yeah. Magnifico, I'm still puzzled about how to get Trauma Tech. Do you have to have the Trauma Reference equipped continuously in order to get the skill like you do with Feathers from the Feather Cloak, results from the HK Games helmet? Ish. You have to have it equipped to get the skill. Does having other sources first aid in addition to the trauma reference prevent or impede you from making progress towards the skill? It doesn't impede it. I'm not gonna... Oh, I guess prevent or impede. Oh, it doesn't do either of those. So don't worry about that. Al and I were discussing the chronology, and since it looks like the trauma reference is available before the Slags quest appears, is it possible to get the skill without having access to the Slags? Yeah, there's an alternate drop location for that, which I thought people had found. Presumably. Yeah, I'll just assume that it's in the wiki. It's one of the, it's one of the possible crate results in the Midgard Warehouse. Midgard Warehouse was rolled out before the Slags quest proper. So there's a result where you get a bunch of medical supplies, and that's one of the items. Or was when those were rolled out. I might have changed it since then. I don't think so, but... I'm curious about the geography of Old Town, since we now know some skills and bonuses will depend on it. Will there be many zones that are on the shore, underwater, underground, caverns? I would not expect any on the shore or underwater ones. There are always sort of, you know, a chance to have, you know, stuff underneath the other stuff, as unhelpful as that is. It's not next to the lake, though, you know, so any underwater you get would be strictly subterranean, or like, you know, weird dream sequences or something. Some questions from Viscerator. What are your long-term goals for the game? There's so much content already, and you're ever-expanding it. I know there's the old-time quest coming, and you have plans for the ultimate end of the main quest line. Yeah. So, to the extent that everything's sort of mapped out, there's sort of a large block of content. Well, I'm not even going to say a large block of content. There's Cybernetics, which I'd like to get out before Old Town rolls. There's another block of content that's sort of tied up in a world event that I could do either before or after Old Town. I was thinking about doing it before Old Town, but I don't want to have to be another Survivor's Quest where people are waiting for like a year to get the quest. So I might do Old Town and then worry about that, since I haven't revealed what it's going to be and nobody's expecting it. So nobody will be terribly disappointed when they don't get it at first. So Old Town will roll out. There's still a couple stages of major quest after that, I would say. Three-ish. But those aren't really, like, stapled down yet. There's the one after Old Town is downtown, you know, like the city center. That should be really interesting. There's a lot of really cool stuff going on there. It might end up being split into two quests, but the planning on that is very in the you know, imagination stages. So there's that, and then, like, eventually you get to the end of the main quest line, and this is in, like, the... Okay, so, after I stop talking about, like, the Cybernetics, Old Town, the thing that might be before or after Old Town, we're in sort of in speculation land, so this isn't, you know, 100% set in stone. But the end of the main quest line, once that's in, that will sort of close the circuit. That's when the final reincarnation stuff goes in. So you've got that. That's going to be really cool, but it's still a ways off, unfortunately. And then once I've finished that loop, there are two things that I want to work on. Obviously, in addition to, you know, continuing to put out unearthly items and stuff like that. I want to work on more paths through the main quest line. Stuff like, you know, right now you can't kill Hell, for example, no matter how much she may deserve it. And you can't even attack her because she would more than likely completely fucking own you and then not talk to you anymore, which would be a problem. But even if you succeeded in killing her, like, the quest line would largely break down, right? Depending on the other stuff that happens. So going through and reinforcing points like that, so that there's, you know, a line through where, you know, you don't have to help her. You don't have to help, you know, Mikael and Vinny. You don't have to help Lo. All these sorts of, like, plot-driven necessities, sort of pairing those out, and also just, like, reinforcing it with more lines through, you know, different ways to satisfy David's quest, different ways, different, you know, items you can get for Lo to identify, all these sorts of just, like, more and more and more just, like, fleshing out the world, and, you know, entirely different, you know, paths through the entire quest line, like the kill freaking everyone path, which I would really like to do, but obviously I want to, you know, get everything completed first before I run off and start working on stuff like that. Because the way that that's going to work actually won't make sense until the final reincarnation stuff is in anyway, so it would just be weird. Okay, so really just, like, you know, buff that up, all that. So that'll be awesome. And the other thing I want to do at that point is I'll start developing some stuff sort of past that loop on the physical and etheric side. So, like, net stuff, there's some net stuff at the end, and there's, like, PvP, right? And that'll sort of keep getting pushed out. But also some stuff, like, going... There are people that you want to go after that you don't actually have to go after to complete the main quest line. How about that? That I'd like to have, like, you know, like, epic quests, basically. Like, post, you know, you can reincarnate whenever you want, but you can also go off and, you know, get these guys, you know, bring them to justice in a variety of ways. So you've got, so those are the two main areas that I'll focus on at that point. And also, you know, adding in, you know, at the end there, adding in some more PvP stuff like that. And the net and PvP will be expanded as I go through, too. There are two little zone revamps I want to do at some point, too, but those aren't tied to Old Town. So, cybernetics has to come in before Old Town, or, like, when Old Town rolls, because there's cybernetics clinic there, so unless I want to put, like, a, you know, closed for business sign on it when we start out, it's a separate issue. So, those are sort of the long-term plans. On the other side of the long-term plans, what I would like to do, is, obviously, I need to get more donation items out to do this, but I would like to, there's sort of a feedback loop of sorts, like, get donation items, go to cons or do advertising, get more players, get more donations, go to cons, do advertising, get more players, get more donations, right? And the get more players includes all of the word of mouth from those players to everybody else. And I would like to... That loop is sort of stalled at the moment, because I'm a, you know, complete fuck-up and haven't gotten the mirror out yet. But the... I would like to rev that up, basically, and to really just basically grow the player base, and that's, you know, at some point in the distant future I might be able to, you know, support myself and Puyo and then, you know, whoever we get. As additional folks, in, you know, the increasingly distant future. But what I'm really focused on now is obviously the development side of getting stuff like Old Town and, you know, cybernetics and these other things that I'm teasing about, but don't want to explain too much, because otherwise I'll have to answer for them later, like pets. Is getting, like, that cycle going a little stronger. Because what I'd like to do is, you know, I obviously have to, you know, keep the server running and everything, but everything other than that, for the donations, I would really love to be able to feed back into getting more players. Because I mean, I have my day job right now. I don't really need, like, the extra money, but those donations could really, there's some interesting avenues of exploration as far as, getting, you know, the word out, getting new players. And obviously, you know, we've got, people, you know, doing reviews and whatnot. That helps a lot, too. And just, you know, the general word of mouth. But there's only so much that I can do to really encourage that. And before anyone listening thinks of or suggests rewarding people for getting new players, it really doesn't work very well. It encourages a lot of abuses. So that aside, but I would just like to, you know, bring new players into the fold that way. Once those are implemented, I did say long term, will you remove resets? I can't imagine Metroplex without resets. It wouldn't be possible to remain the same year. Oh, no, absolutely not. No, the reset option that you see here is a faint mockery of the final reincarnation option. That you'll get once the main quest line is done. the once it is done, yeah, there's going to be a lot of really cool stuff in there that I'd really love to be working on now, but, you know, that's still a ways off. And I can't just, like, chop a bunch of quests off the end because it ties into the plot at the end there. But, alas. But no, yeah, the reset is only going to grow. And something else that I think I would like, something that I would like everyone to hold me to, I'm not sure how I'm going to do it yet, but I really want to do it, is we have these sort of, you know, couple-day resets, right, that we're doing now, like, you know, 3-4 day, what have you, if you're, you know, being speedy. And obviously, as the main quest line is completed, those will take longer and longer and longer. And I think that's awesome. Like, we want to have that option. What I would also like to do, and I don't know how I'm going to do this yet, so just something to nettle me about once we get to the end, is I would like to have some of the reincarnation options actually feed into shorter lines, basically. So what I was saying about having different lines for the main quest, it's entirely possible, and you can sort of see this with how the boards are structured now. You know, you've got people who are doing Hal, people who are doing Baldur, people who are doing Sif, people who are doing Loki, or Dr. Amundsen, though, I guess I should say, are on different boards, effectively, right? So that the technology can obviously be spread, but that means that we could have a 2 or 3 day option, like a much, you know, shorter quest line, and not have it be in competition with the main one. Or even have like a very a la carte type option. And that would end up like a almost like a 1 day type reset, which would have to have some other sort of requirements. And these aren't obviously set in stone yet, so I have no idea how I'm going to do them. But one of the things that will happen with the final reincarnation system is that the choices you make there will really feed back into your next incarnation, and the choices you really make through the entire quest. So if you can, like, the kill everyone line, for example, would actually be unlocked at the end. You go through. Or one of the kill everyone lines. The one that I have in my head right now would be unlocked at the end and kind of come back through. But yeah, I would like to have some of those options feed back into smaller loops, basically. And obviously those will have to be very lovingly crafted, but I would really like to see that. Actually, I have some ideas now. So, anyway, resetting is there to stay. Also, what would you say is the single earthly item that has the largest amount of stuff left to discover? Let's see. I'm not going to tell you directly because I'm a jerk like that. But it's actually something under the under Stolen Artistry. So one of the branches under Stolen Artistry. Several of the branches under Stolen Artistry have stuff left to discover, but one of them has just a, like, massive, like, swollen ball of content left to discover. I'm still picturing it as, you know, a tree, so you're, like, the giant like this, which makes it sound really unpleasant, but it's all really neat content, and I really enjoyed writing it, so. Which of our contacts was your favorite to write? Probably the Vigilante. I enjoyed sort of the the interplay with the, like, recording and his personality through time as he's, you know, finding out new things and recording pieces. That was a lot of fun. I also did enjoy Zero Five Cleaner. Just in the sense that we got a lot of personality out of him, and, you know, sort of foreshadowing his final fate. A couple more from Viscerator. Is fishing XP random, or do you get better at fishing when you hit some hidden value, total volumes on a caught, number of times fished, or is there some combination? So there's sort of, like, two parts of fishing XP. There's the... It works very much like the attributes. You know, there's the individual XP, and then there's the actual rating, right? And both of those will tell you when they go up. So, like, you know, you get better fishing, you've gained, you know, you're now whatever rating, right? Like, you get the separate messages if you go up a rating. But that's the part that's tracked. And it's not really truly random. It's related pretty deeply to, you know, where you're fishing, what you're fishing on, that sort of thing. So if you're, you know, sitting on the docks, you're only going to get so high in your fishing skill, and you'll just stop getting XP after a certain point. And, you know, the other areas have their own caps. But some of them really, yeah, there's a lot more of, there's a lot more to find out in that, but it's not, there's not a hidden counter there that you can't see. The only counter there is the one that you're actually being told about. Back in the day, there was a hidden counter that nobody could see, but with the fishing revamp, that's all exposed now. Is there anything you've done in Metroplexy, item design decision, event, etc., that in retrospect you think you could have done better or wish you hadn't done? I mean, pretty much anything I put out, I want to, you know, have some go back and be like, yeah, I really wanted to do this better. There's always, you know, something that doesn't quite work right. One that leaps to mind, probably because, you know, we just finished with the hacking event, is I kind of wish that when I was going through hacking, I had been coding it in a more rigorous manner. It's very... So pretty much everything else pulls really heavily from the database. There's a fairly small amount of code. The rest of it's pulled from the database and then interpreted by that small amount of code, if that makes any sense at all. The hacking stuff, not so much like what happens with the sites. Like, I think the way that I implemented that works fine. But, like, the way that the hacking combat works is much more hard-coded than the way that normal content that works. And I really should have kept that in mind, because it's just the code ends up being a lot more brittle, basically. It's just whenever I change something, I'm a lot more likely to break stuff. But other than that, I feel that stuff, like, the other one that I'm not going to say I beat myself up for, but I learned a lot from, I guess, is the Vigilante Quest, which is sort of a PvP arc, that takes you through, like, all the PvP areas in Vigilante, doing Vigilante Justice, and all this stuff, sort of in following the tracks. The Vigilante, who I just mentioned. There was a clue of sorts, which was supposed to be like, it was just a wall, basically. And when you're going through the quest, I think if you're going through the quest in the order that it was intended, you see the wall and you're like, oh, this reminds me of this from earlier in the quest, like, and you kind of you can figure out how to get through it. Maybe I did a terrible job at that too, but sort of beside the point, what happened was that that got found far before the first half of the quest got found. So this is like this area in the middle. It doesn't do anything. Just like is taunting people and being frustrating. So like if you listen to like the first like 10 podcasts, that's probably not true. The first stretch of podcasts, there's a lot of like, seriously, what the hell is up with that wall? And it's like, oh, I really, really should have done a better job with that. So, that, I think, informed back how, you know, I work on, you know, mysteries and quests as a whole. Also, can you go into some details about how chat works? Badly. As a developer, it's the part of the game that I most wonder about. What I'm thinking is that it's a big PHP page with an input box that writes to a database. When it loads, it displays the past X messages or all messages from the past X minutes and filters out those that you can't see. Am I on the right track there? Yeah, that's almost exactly how it works. What I need to do is scrap it and rewrite it all in Ajax. But I don't know Ajax, so I need to learn Ajax, scrap it, and rewrite it all in Ajax. Or, more likely, learn Ajax, write an Ajax chat, hide the current stuff, have everyone switch over to Ajax, make sure it works, and then scrap it. Because that's important. Version control is important. But yeah, no, that's about how it works. Some more questions from Francis Vixen. Is there anything more to discover about the replica sword? Yes. There's some neat replica sword related stuff. Nothing earth-shattering, but I tend to give it a nod whenever it should come up. Any hints as to the use of the preserved cell culture? Let me make sure I'm thinking about the right one here. I should have just brought up the database. Interacts with some of its kindred. Let's see. Any hidden content regarding the Mass of the Assailant sketch? I think that's been found. The coded content. Now, what it means is a separate issue. As far as code, I think all of the branches of the code have been going through what it means. Well, that's up to everyone to figure out. Which is faster, the African or the European swallow? Well, it depends if they're carrying a coconut. Is there any real use of the slammer bottle? I seem to recall that it grants some PvP-ness. Some other exciting things. But Well, that actually, you just gave me a good idea. For those who are unaware, this is the sound of me updating the database. Something really obvious that the broken bottles should have had that wasn't developed when I put them in. And so I'm putting that in there right now. Let's see, I think those are the only two broken bottles. Yeah, okay. But relating to the slammer model, they're not really intended to be, like, you know, the most amazing weapon ever. Just sort of a easy way to get a plus PvP weapon, otherwise you can, you know, grind them down into glass if you want to. Any chance of implementing etheric Lego bricks we can use for fun? If it would not surprise me to find something of that nature eventually. But you'll find different modular designs, probably. I really like modular designs. They tend to be a giant pain to design from my side and actually implement. But, yeah. Will we eventually gain the option of paying to expand the size of our apartments? Yes. That's one of the many things that is sort of on the whenever I end up having time needing to do it front. We might finally hit the wall with the mirror. What I'm really waiting for is, so right now there are sort of like 3 slots in your apartment. And before you upgrade to like 4 or 5 slots, I would really like that to be a meaningful choice. And more importantly, I would like the 4 or 5 slots to also be, like, at least a little meaningful. So the so it's just as there's more furniture produced, that just becomes more lovely, basically. Lastly, thanks so much for MS. He's been a real blemish to the great community here. Kudos to all of those who stood up for me. You have no idea how much I'm thankful for that. I guess this gives new meaning to the phrase, don't be a stranger. Anyways, you guys are awesome. Thanks again. Yeah, actually, there was a real public outcry in my inbox when I got back. Actually, I also want to add a little bit of thanks there, because the tone of basically every message that I got was like, and there were a lot of them, was basically, this guy's causing a problem, I'm sorry to be bothering you with drama when you're just getting back from vacation, but really, this is way over the line. Which it was, and everyone kind of, like, came together to community agree on it. But I'd like to thank everyone for both, like, coming together on that and, you know, trying to deal with it, you know, on a community level first, and really, respecting my time as far as that goes. That's really, there was really just a lot of awesome there. So, thank you. Question from Dire Cohort. That's pretty awesome. Are you planning on any non-sushi food crafting options, aside from the occasional chemistry combinations? There are probably some deep fryers that could fit in our apartments, and if chemistry fair is in any indication, you could deep fry anything. Couldn't be much worse for us than Eclipse. So there is plans for actual cooking. The trick with actual cooking, though, is that you need actual cooking ingredients, and part of, this is going to sound sort of weird, but part of the, like, the setting, I guess, is that even the people in the lower classes who have enough to eat are eating basically entirely, like, crazy pre-processed crap. So getting actual, like, ingredients that you can use in cooking is fairly difficult. So that will come up more as we go forward through through the main quest line, because like Old Town is actually not like a great neighborhood. It's not like, you know, like ritzy, I guess is what I would say. But like it's a step up. Like that's the sort of place where you can expect to actually find like fresh fruits and vegetables, and, you know, flour and stuff like this. So I would not be surprised to see cooking unlocked during the Old Town quest. And if not, then after it, and if not, then downtown. But I'm pretty sure it'll just be during the Old Town quest. A fryer would be fast. From our, deep fried eclipse, which just sounds delicious. There are certainly enough candy bars to deep fry, which are kind of good. Can I stop watching? Oh, this is, I'm sorry, this is from Sir Cheddar. Can I stop watching the subversion testing board? My eyes are starting to hurt. That should be... I'm torn. I can get that up and running again and probably like a day's effort. But doing that would push the mirror out yet another day. So I'm just sort of... I'm torn as to whether to do... to delay that and get the subversion testing board working again. More seriously, if you didn't answer these all with Alan's question already, the board seems to be on hold at the moment, at least a total of 4 days since the event has ended, or are we missing something? No, it's not active right now. If we haven't, do we plan to do something with it in the future? Yes. If so, a time frame should be spent soonest before Old Town, after Old Town, or after the next nutter comes up with the irrefutable math back over about the rapture. Soonish. It would either be in the next week or after the mirror comes out, whichever that ends up happening. Will there be a source for more Comdish cores? That seems reasonable. Also, I like the deep frying idea. Deep frying sounds like a must for a greasy rundown apartment. I don't think many greasy rundown apartments actually like have their own deep fryers. Speaking, I guess, as someone who has had deep fryer, they're actually kind of a pain. Not saying that I won't include them. And just, like, having crafting recipes that are, like, X item plus frying oil is just kind of awesome. I would expect any sort of deep fryer as a addendum to cooking, or possibly, like, an alternate path for unlocking cooking. I guess we could have cooking and frying, but... Kind of silly awesome, maybe, but, I'm sorry, I'm just lost in trains of frying. Okay. Well, okay, well, it's only an hour and 38 minutes long, so I'm going to go on a, I'm done with questions, by the way. So if you're only listening to see if your question got answered, you can stop now. And if I didn't answer your question, that's really weird, because I read through the whole thread. The other thing that really struck me while I was in Australia with the Anadu at Uluru is how much... the rune quest and, like, hero quest. I'm not sure. I might be misusing that name. I think there are two hero quests, one of which is rune quest and the other of which is the board game from the 80s. That was awesome. Don't deny me. One of the concepts in hero quest is that, I'll say rune quests so that we're on the same page. One of the concepts of rune quests is that there are hero quests, which are like sort of metaphorical recreations of the acts of the gods during the god time, which is like the time before time, basically, when the world was being created and all of this. And it was interesting. And I'm sure it's not like a weird coincidence, but it was interesting to see how much the dream time was reflected in that. It really makes me want to run something like RuneQuest now, but we're in the middle of a Pathfinder game still. But just the idea of it really more deeply informs this. So ritual magic shows up in a lot of games, in a lot of RPGs, a lot of I should say tabletop like fantasy role playing games. Probably the narrowest definition for what I mean. But they don't really tie it into the world usually. In that, like, well, 4th edition D&D would be a pretty obvious example. They have these rituals to, you know, use magic outside of combat, basically. Because otherwise it's the only time you really use it. Like, your utility powers, but whatever. But it's not really sunk into the world at all. But something like that HeroQuest framework, especially when you start layering it with these sort of, you know, like the places and the, you know, you've got your history, your place, your sort of your culture and your sort of ecology almost layers. Which is actually a pretty good way to look at most of those stories, and the HeroQuest. Really tying is sort of coming from that direction into the HeroQuests as a magic system is something that I think could be really interesting. Not for really a format like Metroplexity, but as like a sort of a tabletop role playing game, or really just as like a part of a setting for a tabletop role playing game. Using something like Iron Heroes would be good, because it doesn't really have its own. It has a magic system, but it's kind of awful. You just don't use it. Because the combat stuff is all really cool. It doesn't use magic. It's very Conan-y. Like, there are people with magic, but they're bad people. You stick swords in them. very traditional fantasy in that way. But tacking something like that onto there, sort of like a ritualized recreation of events from, you know, the gods and, you know, the ancient spirits and whatnot to take on a reflection of their power, etc., etc. Then using that as sort of the backdrop for if you're doing something like Iron Heroes, probably like a feats system, you know, based off of these ritualized accomplishments and things like that, and tying it more and more closely to the divine power as you go up the feat tree, that sort of thing. Or, you know, just like free bonuses, because who doesn't like free bonuses, for actually tying your character to the world. And I think that's actually the really interesting part about it from a role-playing perspective, in that you always have, you know, the characters, and they usually have some sort of connection, right, to the world if you're running, you know, a remotely story-based game. Like, you know, they have the town that they all grew up in, they're defending, which is how my Pathfinder game right now works. Well, the town that one of them grew up in and adopted the other two, but neither here nor there. But, so there's that, but like an actual, like, a mechanic for gaining power by tying your character more closely to the world is really kind of an interesting concept. And there are some systems that do sort of similar things in a variety of ways. Actually, I don't think Houses of the Blooded do this, but you could probably do it in Houses of the Blooded or Fate or what have you. It would have like an aspect that ties you into the world, but just like the very, like, the mechanic of sort of taking part of the world into your character, and that granting you, like, a notable mechanical benefit. And, you know, just the trick is obviously making it so that it's, A, approachable as part of the world, and then, B, making it so that, discouraging as much as possible people from, you know, just cherry-picking them. Being like, oh, you know, like, prestige classes in 3rd edition D&D were very much just like, oh, well, it's not about, like, this class, or, like, what the class tells me about, like, the world or the order that my character is part in. I'm just, you know, taking it for the list of mechanical benefits. But I think that there's a core there that can turn into something pretty cool. It's neither here nor there, I guess. At some point in the distant future, I like the distant future, don't I? I would like to be able to sit down and design. Well, I guess I design them anyway, but actually, like, write out and make available, probably as PDFs, a number of, one or more, let's say, tabletop RPGs. I would like to actually be able to do that with Metroplexity, because I think that actually you could do some really cool stuff with that tabletop. But I would have to tell you stuff. It isn't revealed in the game yet, and I'm that big of a jerk. I just think that there's a lot of really, really interesting stuff in there. I think that there's a lot of space in Metroplexity that isn't going to be, you know, explored through the main quest line, and would be, you know, if you have, you know, your party of, you know, fangs, or, you know, Midgard enforcers, or, you know, just random, you know, street people of either of the class that the PCs in, you know, Metroplexity, the game, are, you know, the current game, or just, like, you know, normal people, and seeing how that falls out. And, you know, see a little more of the world, stuff like that. Anyway, that's not even, like, that's, like, past finishing the main quest line and a bunch of other stuff. What I have, like, staff. And can take a while and write some stuff. But, yes, that's a little glimpse into the sort of stuff that's spinning around in the back of my head. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and enjoyed playing. I am hard at work on the mirror, the next unearthly item. If folks would like me to go through and take care of the leaderboard for Hacking Subversion first, I can go ahead and do that. Just if you have an opinion one way or another, go ahead and just say it in the comment thread that I open. For, you know, post podcast commentary, just go ahead and comment in there, and I'll, if there's a public outcry for getting the subversion testing back up and running, I'll take a day and do that, and if not, I'll just keep on with the mirror, and then once I'm done with that, I'll go back and do the subversion testing. Then once I'm done with both of those, I will, actually probably start working on Cybernetics. I should probably take a day and get a big art request to Puya, because I don't have most of the cybernetics art yet. But that's probably my next big thing. So you'll get cybernetics and the experimental clinic in the university would open at that point. So that'll be cool. That's probably my next big project once I get those two done. And then either Old Town or some of the other stuff that I'd like to be done before Old Town, but, like, really, it's not the end of the world if I don't, so I might just dive right in. And feel free to leave commentary on that, too, if you'd like to have, like, random goodies or Old Town, or have me mix it up, which might be best, actually. Might work best to do, like, to be working on Old Town in the background and give you the random goodies as I go through. Maybe even do that with Cybernetics, actually. That's worth thinking about. Anyway, taking up enough of your time, but I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I hope you I've enjoyed playing, and we should be back with that mirror, as soon as we can. Thanks, have a good one.